You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
Well, I wonder if Australia could get in on that act. Well, we'll perhaps ask our next guest, because we're going to have now on the show Peter Irwood from the Space Association of Australia and Lachlan Thompson from the RMIT University. Welcome to the show, folks.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Andrew. Good to be back.
Peter, we're going to let you lead on with the questions today.
Sure. Yeah, as a background, I attended the Australian Space Science Conference last week here in Melbourne, and among one of the many interesting presentations, I was fortunate enough to be in the room to witness Lachlan's presentation. So I thought everyone would be interested to hear a little bit more about that. But before we talk about what Lachlan's main topic of discussion here tonight, I just wanted to have a chat to you, Lachlan, and talk a little bit about your background. You're an Associate Professor of Aerospace at RMIT University in Melbourne here.
That's correct, and I teach space vehicle design.
Wonderful. A lot of interest. Listeners would be most interested in that. Some of the things I'm reading here on your bio, some of the things you've been working on are radar applications for real-time management of forest firefighting, is that correct?
Well, that's correct. We discovered that most agencies try to filter radar or the fire signature out of radar, and the defence wants to see through fire and smoke to hit the target. The Weather Bureau wants to see water vapour, not fire. And we said, hang on, radar can scan a broad range of frequencies. Let's optimise a radar to look at fire, and we've done it. And we can integrate that as a ground-based system, a UAV-based system, that's an unmanned aerial vehicle, and a space-based system, integrate all three together, and you could have a national early fire detection system that would detect a fire 1 metre cube instantaneously with real-time firefighting direction.
Wow, that would be really helpful. Well, hopefully we won't have to use it, but if we do need to use it, it's good to know that there's some good progress and once again, good application of space being made beneficial for everybody on the ground here. Some of the other things I'm reading here, Lachlan, you've done is some research in 3D laser sintering to manufacture regenerative cooled rocket motor engines. Could you talk about that?
Well, RMIT and some of its industry partners have introduced a 3D laser sintering process. That is that three lasers focused on a point into a field of, let's say, powdered nickel or copper. It will melt the metal and fuse it to sort of a fraction of a millimetre ball. As you move the lasers along, you get a continuous line. You put a bit more powder in, and then you can add another dimension, like you can grow in height. And literally out of a sandbox, it's really Star Trek replicator stuff. I kid you not. We can build a three-dimensional, hollow, liquid-cooled rocket motor, and that's what we're doing at the moment. It's absolutely mind-boggling fantastic.
Wow, that sounds great. So is this the 3D printing that NASA's been talking about using for space-based building of projects and things? Is that related to that?
It is related to that type of technology, and we're very fortunate. We're working with a German company and some Australian companies, and we're putting together basically our own spin on it to benefit Australian companies.
Brilliant. So that's great. That's once again seeing some real benefits for industry and high tech in Australia. That's wonderful. Good to hear that. I'd like to perhaps have you back and give us an update on
how that's all going. I'll bring an engine in for you to play with. How about that?
You have a deal, my friend. Very good. Now, another item here, the ASRI Rockets, a concurrent design facility for space mission design. Tell us about that.
Okay. This is inspired by the European Space Agency's concurrent design facility. A friend of mine, Massimo Bandecchi at ESA in Noordwijk, developed 10 years ago a computer-integrated system where you have your structure specialist, your aerodynamic specialist, your space mission specialist, you have the customer, if it's a satellite, the launch provider, and you bring along all your software that you would use to design the entire system. He came up with a way of integrating it all together so that as you made a design change on the satellite, it told you how much extra fuel you could work out straight away, how much extra fuel you needed in the rocket, or whether you needed to change to a different rocket or design a new rocket. Instantaneously, they took a design process that would normally take them 3 years to 3 months. It took them from a reliability of product of 67%, okay, that's 33 failures in 100, which is not good, to 98% success rate, i.e. 2 failures in 100. And they're getting better all the time. We're not a partner with the European Space Agency, so we can't use their technology, but I worked with them for about 6 months, and Masimo was quite forthcoming, and we've been able to get a student group together to build up a design system. In fact, one of my students presented a paper on the system at the recently finished space conference, and he won the Best Student Paper Award from the National Space Society.
Wow.
For his presentation and the technical content of his paper. Oh. What we're going to do is we will have here in Australia a computer-based design system that can network with other universities. All you need is a computer conferencing room. We can use the NBN to link up and pass high-speed data. So we can work with Sydney University, who's doing a nanosatellite program. They can make changes to the nanosatellites. They might say, look, we really want to squeeze this in. Can we do it? We can sit down, run it on one of the ASRI launch vehicles that we're designing and building at RMIT University, and say, look, sorry, you can't do that, but the best we can give you is an extra 250 grams that you can add. Or, yes, you can do it. We've got the capacity because we've done the real-time simulation with you, and they can see the results as well. We can make the changes instantaneously as they make the changes. So it will cause, within the universities, a significant speed-up in student learning.
Yeah.
A student that makes a change in a satellite will straight away see the impact it makes to the launch provider as to the problems he's causing or she's causing, and be part of the solution. And so we work together, and it becomes a two-way process. It's the way of designing advanced complex systems of the future.
That's fascinating. Now, you mentioned OSROC. You are involved with ASRI as well in the OSROC projects. Are you using the sintering rocket engine printing solution to build engines for those OSROCs? Or?
It is our aim to do there. We've got a two-ton thrust rocket motor at the moment. That's the largest we can make, and that's fine for an upper stage. RMIT University has a student volunteer team working on OSROC 2.5, which is a suborbital rocket, which we're hoping to launch in 2014. And OSROC Nano is a three-stage to orbit launch vehicle. It's on a rubber band type when we'd be ready to launch, but it's a complex program, but we're getting there, and we've already made some hardware for it, such as the gimbaling system, all the tank interfaces. It's coming together. What we've tried to do with the Australian Space Research Institute is say, instead of trying to get part of your rocket made in one university, another bit over here, because we haven't got this concurrent design facility, or haven't had this concurrent design facility, we can't communicate very well to get all the information together. Let's concentrate at RMIT University, get a critical mass of students involved, and actually make some serious progress. And once we've got the concurrent design facility on board, then we can engage other universities to actually get somewhere. In the past, doing it scattered across the university was taking too long. These steps that we put in place 2 years ago, when we started, have yielded significant changes. We've already got, for OSROC 2.5, all the fuel tanks made, the rocket motors finished, the nose cones finished, we've got all the airframe structure ready to be fabricated, all done up on CAD, and we've got the jigging and the tools ready to go. With OSROC Nano, which is a three-stage to orbit, we've finished the design on the first and second stage. We're designing the flight control system, because it's an active flight control system. It's a gimbaled rocket motor. That means, for anyone that's not quite sure about it, means that the rocket motor moves to steer the spacecraft in the atmosphere and in space. And that requires a very fast and sophisticated, reliable control system. And we have a student team on that as well.
That's fascinating. Well, there you go. Rockets being built in Australia. Who would have known that? All right, Lachlan. Let's fast forward a little bit and talk about Australia, the Australian space scene in 2012. And as a background to that, talk a little bit about what sort of led us to where we're at, what the situation is right at the very moment. And people may or may not be aware there is an Australian Space Office as part of the Department of Innovation. Would you like to talk us through sort of where we're at and where we've come from and where you'd like to take us?
Okay. Australia has enormous gaps in its significant space activity. If you looked at government initiatives, 1958 was the number one. We signed up with the Committee for the Peaceful Use of Outer Space through the UN as a charter member, and that was a big initiative for Australia. After that, we dropped the ball as a nation. We've sort of thought about going to space and never ever got there. And it's really a matter of wistful thinking rather than wishful thinking, basically going nowhere fast. We've been invited to join the European Space Agency 3 times, and we haven't been able to make up our mind to give a decision.
Is that based on because they want a joining fee? Or
yes, they have a subscription fee. Mm-hmm. Canada signed up. They earn 128% on their investment each year.
Minimum. So they earn 128%. So
yeah,
it's a positive
money.
Investment.
They've been making money. Their whole advanced robotics industry that's now a billion-dollar export earner for Canada is all based on their work with the European Space Agency, and they sell their services to NASA. That's how you get the Canada Space Arm on the shuttle and the ISS.
Wow. Are you listening, Wayne Swan and Julia?
They were smart. They realised that the technology needed to make a nation good and great and to grow for the 21st century, you needed to be an active player in space.
Perhaps we could pop in here with a couple of historic clips. In 1996 on the Space Show, Malcolm Farrow, the executive director, or then the executive director of the Australian Space Council, had this to say about new policy initiatives for a national space program.
On the first of those, we will be looking to develop and demonstrate Australia's capabilities in the launch sector. We will be promoting Australia as a preferred launch site, and we will be looking to underpin the technology for Australia, and also to develop strategic alliances with other countries' space programs.
And we have to leave Malcolm there. Basically, he was saying that they were trying to get some new policy initiatives up for a national space program, but as Lachlan has been telling us, it didn't happen. Now, Elio Grohovis is a space... Well, at this time he was speaking, was in the Space Policy Unit, which was a part of the Department of Science, Technology and Industry and Tourism. And he was making the point that there was no space policy.
I think you'll all probably be aware that there really is no such thing as a national space policy present. In fact, I'm not certain that there ever was. I've been with the Space Office since late 89, and despite the fact that there was an Australian Space Board and an Australian Space Council and vast numbers of very glossy documents called, a strategy for space industry or something like that, and then the subsequent 5-year plan machinations of the Council, I don't think there was a policy that was endorsed by government for space for Australia. In fact, I'm quite confident that there isn't one now and there never has been one. And I think that this issue has to be addressed. It is the only way that you can get government to commit to at least some very fundamental parameters that will govern how this industry will or will not develop in this country.
Now, Lachlan, do you have any comment to make having heard that now?
Well, the fact that we still don't actually have a far-reaching space policy, for that matter, or direction in Australia, is a function, really. The responsibility comes back to those people engaged in space, not to convince the government, but to convince all the industries in Australia. Because a space agency or a space direction for any nation is driven by its local industry. We all get confused with the big NASA blue disc and the little red rocket whizzing across it, and we think NASA is a massive Disney world of everybody building rockets, and you open up this magic door and there's all these little NASA astronauts running around with spanners and making things go. It's not like that. NASA's an office. It's a boring place. It's actually people in suits, normal business suits, not space suits, and they sit down there and they shovel paper and they administer the future directions of the nation's technology. Basically, it's the private industry, like SpaceX, that we've heard about just recently with their launch coming up. They are the companies that are actually driving the space industry. They're the companies that generate the new technology to solve the problems that the National Space Agency is actually setting as its goal point for the nation. It's the Boeing that built the Saturn V that generated dozens of spin-off, hundreds actually, of spin-off businesses that didn't exist before. Barcode readers, for one, that are taken for granted these days. That type of creation didn't exist before. It had to be made so that Boeing could build the Saturn V to go to the moon. And we take it for granted. We've all heard about Teflon. People have flogged that to death. But DuPont wouldn't have developed it if it hadn't been for a need to solve a problem in the space industry.
Okay.
That's where it all goes.
Now, Elio, by the way, is a graduate of RMIT University, where you teach.
Oh, he's someone that's got a similar site.
Yes, and he's a former director of the program section of the Australian Space Office. But in this clip that comes from 1998, he was speaking as a member of the Space Policy Unit of the Australian Federal Government. And we're playing this to show the confusing evolution of government-funded space organisations here in Australia.
I'm the head of the Space Policy Unit within the Department of Industry, Science and Tourism. As of next Monday, however, there has been a further reorganisation within the department, and I will also be taking over the aircraft industries people and the defence industries people, and they'll be combined with the Space Policy Unit people and will be known as the Aerospace and Defence Industries Group. And the total number of people in the organisation will be about 10, which is a good thing in that I know that from an industry department, particularly the defence aspect is fairly low-key, as is the aircraft manufacturing side, so hopefully we'll be able to divert some of those resources towards progressing a number of space imperatives that have been long awaited and very necessary before people such as Brian and others can progress. I joined the Space Office in 1989, as an engineer, and headed what was basically the Space Engineering section, although it had a number of names in the time that I've been there, but on the last count it was the Space Engineering section before the whole thing folded up. The type of work we were involved in at the time was promoting and setting up space instrumentation projects and some infrastructure projects. And apart from the funding, we're also involved with the OSPACE, the CSIRO, and the ACRS people in developing the program plan for the Total Areas project. And we participated in a peripheral way with the actual Phase A. About the time we concluded those activities, the Space Office closed down and the Space Policy Unit was formed.
Well,
That was 14 years ago, and, well, we've done a little bit. There's some activity around the country, but I think it's time that we took a broader step. And Lachlan, you've got some thoughts and opinions and initiatives in mind for that. Do we need an Australian Space Agency?
Well, yes, we do, but not a Disney Space Agency, as I mentioned earlier. What we need is a commitment from the nation. It's not, our politicians aren't going to do it just on space advocates. It requires all our industries in Australia to realise that when the mining boom goes, how are they going to survive? There won't be all the subsidies to prop them up. GMH will not get its $200 million to keep it going. Where is the technology development going to come for? Our industries can't afford to do the technical risk to develop the new innovative technologies they need to be competitive on a world market in the future. We have to give them to them. Europe has discovered the secret of how to do that. It formed the European Space Agency. The little Volkswagen you see advertised on the television today, parking itself, auto park. That auto park technology came through the European Space Agency to develop the parking software to park the ATV to dock with the International Space Station. And guess who benefits? A European Space Agency partner country. And there was a spin-off of the technology, auto parking, the radar, the actual software control system, the error checking, all has its origins based in the space industry. Why? Well, Volkswagen wasn't prepared to spend the money. They said it's too high a risk, can't do it, not interested. Like our Australian industries saying, we don't want to invest in big research, it's too risky, we'll do little steps. European Space Agency said, we've got a problem. We've got to resupply the International Space Station. We're developing this technology. What else can we do with it? How can we keep our member states aware that it's going to benefit the nation? In fact, the European Space Agency has in its charter an obligation to transfer technology back to its member states. What I'm advocating is that we need a proper space agency, not a space policy office that makes policy that goes nowhere and has no future, but a space agency actually does something. It signs up intellectual property collaborative development deals with other space agencies.
Okay, from other parts of the world.
Yep. Around other parts of the world, because we're not big enough to go off and, you know, go to the moon ourselves, and that would be the last thing I think Australia should actually do by itself, try to do by itself. What we need to do is get involved and engaged in programs where we have a right to the intellectual property that we develop and its spin-offs. And we engage we create a pathway, a hyperhighway for our small business, for the guys that design specialist screws and fittings, special titanium screws that will work in special environments like high temperature changes so they keep everything tight, for the little companies that do computer software programming, specialist work where they do error checking, which can have applications across to navigation pointing on space probes, but as you develop the technology further and the software program has real benefits in your road traffic control. So you don't get the shutdowns that we get on CityLink as we just had, or Transurban, today in Melbourne where we're gridlocked. We have people developing the smart technology and the spin-offs. And the spin-offs are there to be had if you invest in the hard technology. Our business can't afford the risk, but our nation can afford a limited partnership sharing risk with other space agencies. Bring our industries in, give them the opportunity to compete, because at the moment there is no agreement that allows an Australian company to bid as prime contractor for any European Space Agency project, nor could we bid for a JAXA, that's the Japanese Space Agency project, nor could we bid as prime for an Indian Space Agency program, nor could we bid as prime for a NASA program. All these organisations protect their member state, their owning state. They have it in their national policy. The only way to change this is to have Australia say, we've got a space agency and we've got some very clever people down here with some good ideas. Yes, we're prepared to put up a small amount of money.
How much are we talking?
I genuinely believe we could get into a partnership agreement for in the 10 to 20 million. Bear in mind that Brazil spends $275 million a year on its space activity.
Okay.
But this is pocket money for our nation. What we've got to do is get engaged in developing this risk technology. The windfalls are enormous. TomTom, little sat-nav that, sorry to run brands past
sure,
you,
sure.
But the TomTom sat-nav came out of the Netherlands. It came from two PhD students that were designing a geo-mapping system using the GPS for the European Space Agency. And that was what their PhD was on. And then they said, hang on, we can use this for an in-car sat-nav. And they designed one of the best-selling sat-navs in the world, making millions.
Wow. That's amazing.
Why don't we?
Absolutely.
But the money to do the take the risk, to develop the idea, all came from the original R&D to solve a space problem.
Okay, so Australia does spend money on space at the moment. We do have an Australian Space Office, and they've got a budget of about $40 million, which has been spent over, will have been spent over 4 or 5 years. Is that going to be ongoing? Could that be repurposed for your initiative? What would you see as being the way forward?
The drawback is that whilst the initiatives for the Australian Space Policy Office, the $40 million grants that have gone out over the last 4 years, have been fantastic for universities and some of the local industry, they don't have the right IP connections to facilitate the spin-off technology coming back to Australia.
Which is really where the benefit comes.
Oh, that's where the national benefit, that's where the big dollars are. That's the millions and millions of dollars.
There's a disconnect between investing and return on investment.
Exactly. The European Space Agency is a very clever model. They run a technology transfer program as part of their space agency. And as they find technologies or develop technologies in the space program, they shop around their member state industries and say, look, we've got this idea, but we're not quite sure whether it would work for you in other areas. And that has earned the European Space Agency member states hundreds of millions of euros each year. And they're now getting up to close to half a billion euros from technology transfer going back into Europe from their space investment. It's spectacular. It's an exponential growth. It's making Europe, giving a revitalization to the nation, to all the nations that are part of it.
Now, of course, Australia does spend a lot of money on space over and above the government's investment. You know, we buy services, space services, telephony, other types of services from other countries. Satellites we buy from other countries. We buy the services that are, television broadcasts. There is a lot of money spent on space, but it just goes straight overseas.
Well, we pay retail price for the majority of about 90% of all Australia's space activity. You can say, yes, Australia's evolved in space, but we're paying retail price for it. We're not getting the benefit of being an intellectual property developer, and it's not helping our manufacturing industry. Our manufacturing industry's dying. What's going to happen when the mining industry falls over? What are we going to live on? We're going to become technologically irrelevant, and basically we're just going to become the largest economic disaster island in the Pacific.
Well, that's right. And we also hear about, smart people, and I don't want to tempt fate here, but smart people such as yourself going overseas because the opportunities to study, work and involve themselves in high-tech businesses, industries, institutions are very limited in Australia. So, I think there's a lot of Australians around the world would love to come back to Australia if there was a flourishing space high-tech industry here?
Well, in our aerospace engineering students, we graduate about 100 a year. Of those, around about 30 of that 100 really want to get into the space industry. Of those 30 of them will go and work overseas every year and stay there and don't come back.
So there's an investment we've made.
Yes.
Gone overseas, gone.
And it just goes brain drain overseas. It's like what was happening with the medical industry. We need to invest in technology. Forget about talking about space. Space is technology. It covers medicine. It covers manufacturing. It covers materials. It covers processes. It covers computer software. It covers everything you can think of. If we're engaged in that, we can do R&D that would otherwise be too expensive to do on our own with partners. And we've got to find some partners because the established space agency conglomerates don't necessarily want to share with us and drive in a bargain or a deal that we can share in the IP and join join the technology space race.
So is this a sort of a concept or a cultural cringe, if you want to put it that way, that we have perhaps in Australia whereby people say we should invest in space and they think NASA, they think moon landing, they think multi-billion dollars stuck on the end of a rocket and sent off to a different planet, and sometimes they don't even work. That's not our deal. It's a waste of money for us. Everyone else in the world are good at that. We're not good at it. Is this kind of what the problem we're dealing with here? Is this an understanding issue?
It is an understanding issue. It's an understanding issue that's got to get to the grassroots. The space industry or the people in the space industry haven't been good enough in reaching out to all our industries across the nation and saying, look, the space industry is you. If you need the new technology for where you're going to go, you can get this high-risk research through the space agency and be involved and be a partner, and a spin-off benefits that will come to you. We need our nation to push the envelope for this sort of technology, and we can't afford to fund it alone. We need to do it in a partnership, so we've got to find some partners from somewhere, some other nations that are like Australia that are on the edge, because there are information transfer restrictions that or ITAR that the Americans and European Space Agency will say, well, look, you know, sorry, we don't want you to get involved in that because that's our technology, and it's a continued problem.
Okay, well, we'll continue this conversation in a moment, but first of all, we need to tell people who we are.
And information about LDST, or if you want to join it, then please go to its webpage, www.simplesite.com.
You can hear all the best music from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and today. Whether you like pop or rock, classical or jazz, Southern FM caters for all music tastes from every era. Tune in to 88.3 FM on your dial to hear the hits. The great hits of the past, present, and the future.
Don't you want to go for a ride? Just keep your hands inside and make the most out of life. Now don't you take it for granted.
Well, we're back here with Lachlan Thompson from RMIT, and we're talking about the new Australian Space Agency, which I'm planning to head up myself in a couple of years if things go well. Well, maybe not. But Lachlan, we were talking during the break there. There are other countries in a very similar boat to us, to Australia, and there are other countries that that are looking for partnerships and potentially have something that could offer to us and we could offer to them. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Okay, as Australia, most Australians think of Southeast Asia or the Asia Pacific Rim to develop a space collaborative activities. If you actually look at the Pacific Rim, you've got two of the biggest players in space already. You've got China and you've got the United States, which basically say, well, why can't we be in there too if you're going to have an Asia Pacific Space Association or agency, and they act effectively as a spoiler because of their enormous strength and trading power. It is a trading deal, really, is what we've got to look at. And we should be brave and look at setting up perhaps new associations. And there are countries like Brazil and South Africa that are in exactly the same situation as Australia, with the exception that they've already got space agencies. South Africa's didn't come until 2009, so it's only just got one. And, Australia's not that far behind, but we're collaborating with them, not really as a business venture, sadly, with the Square Kilometre Array telescope, and the benefits back to Australia are obscure because we didn't sign the deals for the technology and IP development, which is a bit sad. But they have a budget of around about $270 million a year, which they spend about $100 million on Meerkat, which is their Square Kilometre Array prototype, and the rest is to try to get their industry involved in space activity. They got the problem with this technology transfer restrictions that come in, that they've been frustrated in projects that they could do with either the United States, with NASA and ESA. They do the projects together, but they don't get the IP benefits back.
Uh-huh.
Brazil is in exactly the same boat, and Brazil has actually invested money in the International Space Station, and they still can't get technology transfer bits back. They're allowed to have two astronauts, but they're not allowed to, and they've got one at the moment, the other one's on credit with the United States. And they can't get any benefit back. So they have been very smart. They've committed $200 million to a space agency, and they're running a number of technology development interests, but they're, like Australia, too small to go it alone. They've developed their own launch capability. They can launch a nanosatellite already, which is, I think, pretty good going.
Mm.
They're actually well cashed up. Brazil's got a fantastic booming economy from mining and agriculture, like Australia, but they're on a peak where we're on the down. And I figure we've got about a two-year window that we could actually do a deal with Brazil and South Africa on, where our economic strength is still high enough from the mining boom to actually form a Southern Hemisphere space agency, because the Southern Hemisphere is underexploited. The Northern Hemisphere nations want access to the Southern Hemisphere. They want access to Antarctica.
Yes.
It's low radio noise, so best for radio telescopes, best optical, lowest light pollution. That's why you have the Magellan telescope in Chile. And so there's a number of countries that want to do space, want to develop space technology, can't do it by themselves, and they're all in the Southern Hemisphere, like Australia. We're sort of anything below the equator is left out in space, effectively.
Right, right. The Southern Hemisphere Space Agency. That sounds fascinating.
But I might add that during the ID that Andrew was playing earlier, you mentioned that what could Austrade do? Well, when you think about it, the space agency is to broker deals for Australia to actually set up a joint agreement to actually, on a business footing, for our industries to be engaged in space-related projects, and with some small amount of government assistance to do the high-risk stuff, so you can get the spin-offs. Austrade, as you pointed out, might be the actual vehicle to be our de facto space agency, because it is geared up for international trade.
Absolutely.
Or something like that model. And that could be quite a clever idea to do. There is one other clever idea that we should actually steal or borrow from somebody else, and that is business incubators.
Oh, yes.
Now, it's not making eggs and hatching chickens. It's hatching money that runs the nation. European Space Agency, for its spin-off projects that often come out of universities, the project might be too small for the company that's bought most of the IP, but there's a little tiny sign application that people haven't thought about. It might be a fetal heart monitor. It might be a nano diffraction grating that no one quite knows what to do or what it is. And here's this PhD student that's invented it and they've said, hang on, this nano diffraction grating, if I put this in an X-ray machine, I will be able to take breast mammograms instead of being able to resolve to 6 or 8 millimetres to detect a tumour in someone's breast. If I use my grating, we would be able to detect a tumour that's less than a millimetre in diameter. Hey, this is a great idea. I've got to find someone, but the company that's taken the idea might be wanting to apply it to something else. So they can go to the European Space Agency. The European Space Agency says, sorry, lad, we've got no money, but we've got staff and resources, and we'll do the business plan for you. We'll do the engineering plan for you. We'll link you with a company that makes X-ray machines for medical use. And this is a really good thing. We have an investment bank for you. We'll give you a 5-year interest-free loan through Rabobank
right,
to get your business started. If you need a couple of $1 million and you can produce a prototype in 2 years, you've got your money, you've got our banking, and away you go. And they've created thousands of small businesses that have sprung up out of the Netherlands, where this was piloted in 1990. And the European Space Agency has said, this is a good thing. They've built a massive centre in the UK, in Sussex. They've done a similar incubator in Italy. They've done one in Germany, and they're building a fifth one in France. And this is generating the technology for the 21st century that's going to make Europe able to compete with China economically. What's Australia going to do? Who knows?
Well, let's hope you've kicked off something and started some movement. I mean, I think that you made the point during the conference, or it might have been someone else. I mean, we can spend a lot of time talking to people who already love and enthusiastic about space, such as ourselves, but really what we've got to try to do is to broaden the audience, bring them along with the concept and the story and clarify the reality of what space is and what it isn't, and what a space agency could be and what it could mean to Australia. So, Lachlan, we could spend the next 3 hours talking. In fact, let's do that. Perhaps not tonight, but tomorrow night you're coming along to our monthly meeting at the Space Association in Oakley.
That's great.
And if anyone's listening, the meeting is on tomorrow night between 7 and 9:30 p.m. at the Oakley RSL. Free to anybody to come along. We're pretty informal. Come down. Lachlan, you're going to do a presentation following on from what we talked about here tonight. And I'm sure you'll answer a couple of questions or two. And Let's keep it going, and maybe we'll have you back here again, and we can talk further.
Yes, I might point out that one of the best things we could do as a citizen of Australia is write to our politician, and also write to any industries you know, and say, "Look, guys, the space industry is going to generate the technology of the 21st century. Australia needs to be part of it. Our businesses need to be part of this."
Absolutely. Now, there is a space industry business council, isn't there?
The people that are in the space industry, because our space industry is very small, it's actually like a fishbowl with 5,000 fishes too many in it.
Oh, okay.
And so it's very hard to get people to even have a clear vision, because everyone's fighting for survival. And that's not what we need at the moment. What we need is a broader vision to look to the future for the nation, not for the immediate future for self. If we want our businesses to survive, and as Mr. Garno has predicted, 10 years at best with the mining boom, what are we going to do in 10 years' time? Because it's going to be downhill from there. And let's plan ahead.
All right. Lachlan, fascinating. We're going to wind up from Andrew. He's got a few things he'd like to get in to air. Thank you once again, Lachlan. I really appreciate you taking the time, and I'll hand this back to Andrew.
Pleasure, Peter.
This is Southern FM 88.3.
Great.
And coming up now is Peter again with more details about the Space Association meeting tomorrow evening.
Oh, beautiful. I'm back again. Yes. Well, as I mentioned before, tomorrow night is our monthly meeting, the October meeting. Yes, it's October already. It'll be on at the Oakley RSL in Drummond Street, Oakley. And it's free to anybody who'd like to come along. They have a restaurant there and a bar there, so if you want to have something to eat and something to drink, you can do that at bar prices. The meeting will have a variety of topics. I mentioned Lachlan will be doing a presentation. We'll also have an edited highlights of a really fascinating space movie, which is using very high resolution imagery from the Apollo mission. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that on the big screen. And we'll have our usual question and answer, Q&A, informal chat about all things space. There's a lot of stuff going on at the moment, and we invite you all to come along. If you need some details, go to www.space.asn.au and all the details are there, and or you can call into the radio show here if you'd like.
Well, thanks, gentlemen, for being on the Space Show.
Pleasure.